But I always think of it as I want, the goal is, and this is not me, it's Chris Voss, who's an interesting guy because he was a hostage negotiator. He literally said.
Sounds like we need more of those in United Methodist Church.
This is Todd Heffernan. Well, we're joined today with Todd Bolsinger. And actually, we're doing this podcast, a little bit of a special pop-up podcast with our friend Todd Bolsinger. I'll tell you more in about a minute, because this is actually going to lead into and frame a conversation that we're going to have at our annual conference, the Texas Conference of the United Methodist Church. And I'll give a little bit more detail and background on that. But most people probably know who Todd Bolsinger is. He's our friend. He's worked a lot with us at Chapelwood, and Matt and I have become good friends with him. He worked with, he's got 30 years of leadership experience. But I do too, and I don't know why you are so much more famous than I am.
Because he's written some good books, John.
For those of you who may not know, Todd has written a bunch of really excellent books. So Canoeing the Mountains has been a real popular book that's helped frame things. Tempered Resilience was very helpful for me during the pandemic. I've read that actually a few times. And you actually wrote a specific book on leadership for a time of pandemic. And it's interesting that you wrote that like before the pandemic came, right?
That one was written right in the middle of the pandemic is what it was. Yeah.
But you're with A.E. Sloan Leadership now, which is one a company that you helped form that does a lot of consulting and leadership work with churches and organizations. And, of course, you've been on staff at Fuller Theological Seminary for many years. And so welcome, Todd Bolsinger, to Pod Have Mercy. And thanks for helping to lead all of us in the Texas Conference in this. Let me just give you a sense of the framework. When we were coming into this, I think Bishop Harvey and our conference leadership team, we wanted this conference to be a little different. We've been through a season, and you're very familiar with all this. Todd knows the ins and the outs of all of this because I've called him and lamented before on this. But so you're familiar that about 50% of the churches in our conference disaffiliated. We were hit really hard. We had a bishop last year that was really working for the other team, didn't make it really easy for us. But, you know, where we are now is in a new space. And the leadership of the conference was thinking, rather than have a bunch of legislation and resolutions and debates and speech for, speech against, and then have a vote, which votes tend to divide us and cause us to pit against. We wanted to have conversations around the table, dialogue, instead of just this percussive discussions. Yeah. And so you've taught us a lot at Chapelwood about how might we questions. And I'm thinking if you were going to give a word of advice to this large group of folks, clergy and lay, that are going to be having conversations about the future and dreams, and how do you frame that for most people that you work with about how to ask the right kinds of questions and learn things?
Yeah. Thank you, guys. It's nice to be with you. When I was pastoring, I had a guy in my church who was a consultant with like a Fortune 100 company, like way up there. Yeah. And he used to say every now and then we'd get in the middle of like some argument in the middle of our council or our board or something, and he would pause and say, "You know, there's a great question in here. I just don't know what it is." And it would remind us that until we got clear on the question, we were often talking past each other.
Yeah.
And so what we've done with our company is we spend a lot of time trying to get people to get to the right question, which starts in a couple of places. So I would just say really quickly, think about it this way. Try to get people to start saying out loud, "I wonder and I worry. I wonder about this, I worry about this." If you say those things out loud, "I wonder about this, I worry about this," then what you do is people can put on the table what they're most curious about and what they're most concerned about. And now we know. Then make sure that nobody gives advice. Like, the rule has to be, when people talk about "I wonder and I worry," you don't give advice. Somebody said to me, and I think it's really bright, unsolicited advice is experienced as a kind of violence. Like you experience it like violence. And you know this, even you know, even well-meaning unsolicited advice, right? People who love you, who tell you things that they think they need to tell you, right? So "I wonder, I worry, no advice." That's the first rule. The second one then is to have people then say back what they heard. Your goal is to say back to someone what they heard, so that they say to you, "Yes, that's right. You understand me. That's right."
Yeah.
Again, the goal is not to get to you're right. Oh, yeah, you're right. It's to get to that's right. So I might say, hey, I wonder if anybody in the next generation is ever going to want to be a United Methodist. I worry about whether we are actually now a dying denomination. And instead of going, hey, we're great, say, no. What I hear is you're saying that you really are worried about the next generation, because it sounds like you really love this. That's right. Boom. If you take those two steps, then the how might we questions become exploratory. And that's what you're trying to get to.
Yeah.
How might we question is how to explore the possibility, not because we're trying to get rid of the anxiety, but because we're trying to acknowledge that it's coming out of our, both the things we care about and the things we're concerned about. Mm.
Mm. That's interesting. I always talk about active listening. That's right. what I always heard that term.
It also seems it helps us not move right into strategy out of our own anxiety. That what it does is it opens up space for kind of the spirit and that imaginative space just to breathe for a while. And as we breathe in that, then I feel like the spirit can move. But we're not then just saying, there's a problem, we got to move now. We can say, wait, let's let the spirit collectively help us.
Yeah, Matt, it's so, you know this, that when people respond with a suggestion, it's always about getting rid of their anxiety.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. And so what you're trying to do is by starting with, hey, I wonder about this, I worry about this, and nobody's going to solve it for you. You're going to disrupt the default to solve by saying, okay, say back to you what you heard. Say back what you heard. That's the act of listening. But I always think of it as the goal is, and this is not me, it's Chris Voss, who's an interesting guy because he was a hostage negotiator. He literally said,
sounds like we need more of those in United Methodist Church.
This is what he said. He said, when you're a hostage negotiator, you can't just come to win-win solutions.
Right.
Somebody says, hey, I took four people hostages, I'm going to shoot four people, give me $1 million. You can't say, hey, shoot two and we'll give you $500,000. Right? You have to recognize you got to get everybody out. And so what you have to do, actually the way of getting everybody out, is identifying with the hostage taker. It's weird. So even if I don't agree with what you wonder about or worry about, if I can make you feel felt, right, that attunement accelerates change.
Yes.
People to say, that's right. That's right. That's my concern. Great.
Yeah.
Pause. Now, what could we explore together? How might we learn what the younger generation thinks of us? How might we ask questions about the kind of church they want to be in rather than worrying about us? How might we, like, I'll make these up at the top of my head, just think like what do I want to learn? That's how might we questions are about learning, not will it work, but what do I learn? So you go from wonder and worry to deep attunement and connection to learning.
Yeah.
And it changes the whole conversation at that moment.
That's really helpful. I think too, you know, when you come to the table when we're having conversations, part of this, you know, the legislative process with resolutions is it's a percussive thing. You know, they talk about discussion. It's like my statement, your statement, my statement, your statement. And it really focuses on the differences, but also you're not listening to the other person. You're listening so you can prepare what your rebuttal is going to be.
And
I think we're trying to do something different, that the results of the conversations from the table become visions or hoped for outcomes that maybe we can entertain experiments with. You've talked a lot with us about taking these learnings and these things that we hear from each other and engaging in experiments. I don't know if that directly relates to the how might we questions, but talk about that a little bit. So when we think about, okay, what comes next after the conversation, or are we just having a conversation, walking away, and nothing happens?
Yeah. So we talk about this a lot, and we've done this. I did this with you guys. It's really fun to look at experiments. What happens with most of us is what we've done with experiments is we've used the word experiment to mean, we're going to do something, and if it goes bad, don't be mad at us. In other words, we're asking the question, is this going to work or not? I want to change the question. The question isn't, does it work? The question is, what do we want to learn? What do we want to learn?
Yeah.
So if I don't know something, then that becomes gold. What do I want to learn?
Yeah.
So here's a question I would say, which is, what do we want to learn about the thing we're anxious about? Mm. Wow. One of the things I want to learn is, I'm very curious why everybody stayed. Like, where are all the people who stayed? Why'd we stay? And I want to learn what would make us start getting energized toward our mission and get over our hurt.
Yeah.
What would help? I don't know those answers, but because I don't know and because I'm not caught up in them, I get really curious about those. And when you start getting, then you can make experiments. Experiments are all about, just think of experiment is about figuring out what we want to learn. What do we want to learn? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times what we do is we talk at people and we try to solve things and we call them experiments. But what we really mean is we're going to try this thing we really want. We hope you're not mad at us if you don't like it.
Yeah.
As this intro part, we wind down so the tables discussions can happen here at annual conference. I did want to share with you and just get your thought. These are the questions that a group of people wrestled with to think about as starting points for the tables to talk about. I just love your input on these and maybe ways to improve the conversation around the table as we're thinking about this. And this came from a lot of interests from different people and different parts of our church. The first one is, and we used a lot of how might we, because I think that's a great way to start. How might we grow in our trust together after so much conflict and division? And what does integrity mean to you? That's really kind of the combo, is how might we grow in our trust together after so much conflict and division? What do you think of that question?
Well, I think it's a great question if it's genuinely curious. Like, so how might we grow in our trust together? Another way is, what do we need to try to grow in our trust together? How might we actually grow in our trust together? That's a good question. Because I'm not sure we know how to grow in that. I can tell you this, as being part of a Presbyterian denomination that had three splits in a generation, we're still pretty mad at the other denominations that left us. We're in full communion with the people that we broke with during the Reformation, but we're not in full communion with our other Presbyterian sisters and brothers who broke with us in the last generation. Mm-hmm. So how might we grow in our trust together? Tariq is really an important question to me.
We can relate to that.
Yeah, we can.
It's kind of like, what do you say? I don't hate anybody, but those people can pound sand.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
yeah.
Exactly. Like, I don't hate them, but
just, you know.
The second question is, how might we live together as a church in the midst of our differing understandings of human fulfillment? I think that's maybe a loaded term there. I think they were trying to find the diversity of ways that we think about living in the world together in the church, especially some of those, I think, that tend to be stressors. But how might we live together as a church in the midst of our differing understandings?
Yeah. And really what I would want to get to is really concrete things. Mm. How might we discover the things that will help us live together? Like, we might discover that having a meeting like this where we're actually talking about our worries helps us a lot.
Yeah.
Right? Or we might discover that what we need to do is have more projects we do together and less talking. What could we experiment with? How might we learn to live together with our differences?
And then the third one is, and it's not a how might we, but I guess you could help us just think about this. How important do you feel the values of diversity, unity, integrity, transparency, and trust are as we move forward? And what types of things should we do to make sure we instill and maintain these values?
Yeah. I think one thing is, how might we clarify our values? Understanding that today we absolutely value diversity, equity, and inclusion. How might we clarify how we talk about them? Mm. Some of us are going to need help. Some of us are just going to need help, right? We get triggered. How might we clarify what is valuable to us? How might we is one of the questions. And when you ask how, what you're actually trying to get people to do is actually figure out how to operationalize something. What's the way we're going to get to? It's not how might we questions are not rhetorical. They should build something. I'll close with this little story that came out of my doing some stuff with the Texas conference. I met with a great group of clergy. I think about them a lot. They were mostly younger side, 30s and 40s. You know, I'm close to 60, so they're young to me. And we spent a whole evening talking. And what we started talking about is they said, like, where do we go from here? And I said, remember, your job is to make great wine, not to have the best wine bottle factory, right? Like, how might we recover what it means, what the world is thirsty for?
Yeah.
How might we recover the wine that makes the world glad, rather than worrying about worrying less about the bottles and the corks and the labels right now?
Yeah.
It seems to me that one of the things we have to recover, because I think we let it either lie dormant or we didn't know how to do this in the last season really well, is really vulnerability and curiosity as a community. Because I think that we had to, at least I think we had to learn how to be invulnerable because of kind of just bracing for impact. And I really think that in this next season, we have to recover our own sense of collective vulnerability and curiosity towards each other.
Oh, I love that you said it that way, because that's what I think about when I think about I wonder and I worry questions. When I tell you what I wonder about, I start telling you about what I'm curious about. When I tell you what I worry about, I'm actually taking the risk to be a bit vulnerable. Mm. Like you're going to have people my age, you're going to say stuff like, I wonder if there's going to be a church for my grandchildren. I worry that it's going to die on my watch.
Yeah.
Right? That I'm going to be the denomination where it went down on. I worry about that. Hmm. And somebody's going to say, oh, no, no, God is good. Yeah. No, stop.
Stop.
You know that God is good? Stop, right? Let's sit there. And then I wonder and I worry. Okay, so come back to me. That's right. Mm-hmm. And then how might we explore? Like, it gets me thinking, how might we explore the kind of church my kids want, so that we might think about what my grandkids might get. Okay.
I love that.
Hey, tell us a little bit. I'd just love to hear, if we turn this into a little of extended edition, whatever. It's like we talked about these questions and stuff, which actually I think the stuff we talked about for the conference is good for everybody.
Oh,
like
absolutely.
When you're talking about the difficult world we live in,
right,
when you're talking about politics and race and just everything, that kind of conversation and learning, that empathy, that's what I call it, listening to other people. Yeah. Tell me, though, what are some of the really interesting things as you're dealing with these diverse groups? What are you learning that you're excited about?
Well, so let me tell you the most recent thing I'm learning. That we work every single day with groups of folks consulting. We work with some big ones. Like I'm coaching the president of a denomination. We're working with a mega church. We're working with international organizations. I've been to Bangkok and Denver. You know, like, right, it doesn't matter, right? What we're discovering is one of the things our research told us that we got, because we did some research with using the Lilly Grant to help us explore some stuff, is people are learning from our content, but they learn the most from their experiments.
Yes.
Like they learn the deeper things in their experiments. We know this to be true, but to actually have some research that proves this is helping us really think about getting people to actually do experiments is really important. And what we realized is most of us actually aren't wired for experiments. We're wired to like hear a lecture, read a book, have a conversation, but to actually go build an experiment together is actually the thing we'll learn the most from.
Y'all need to create a Sloan laboratory system, right? I mean, this is really, these are labs that, I think that's right.
It's kind of what we're doing with where we're getting this is we've got these cohorts where smaller churches who couldn't afford consulting come together and they learn from a coach and they end up doing these experiments. And, you know, we've learned a lot. Like one of the things we've learned from two or three of our churches is the structure of the church is actually set up to sabotage the very work that they want to get, the transformation they want to have happen.
Wow.
And nobody will say that when they're doing it. They only say it when they start. No one will say that when they're studying it or talking about it. They learn that when they're doing experiments. So one church I just talked to today, what we've talked about was they talk about really wanting to be a church where everybody shares and participates in the ministry, but they have a culture of patronage where basically people give a lot of money and then and the staff carries it out and everything's good. So staff have good salaries and people pay a lot of money, but what they don't have is shared participation. And so until they can name that, okay, our patronage culture is keeping us from a participation culture. Cool. They couldn't get that when we were doing all the research with them. They got it when they started doing experiments. Mm. Oh, that's our problem. So
that's interesting. I love his job.
I do too. I do too. Yeah.
You basically have his job, but you have a lot of other jobs with that job.
Oh, yeah. A little bit, right? Right. Yeah. You actually, but the great joy of my life is I spend every single conversation I have is with somebody who actually wants to try to figure out how to make change happen, yeah. as opposed to sitting in a lot of meetings where people are making excuses to not change. Like that's the biggest difference in my job this day.
Huh. There was a quote today I read this morning about how, you know, how much time people spend on efficiently working on things that really shouldn't occupy any of your time. They're just not worth. And yet we spend so much time efficiently laying out how to do these things. And it's like, this is just really not worth your time. It's a waste of time.
Yeah. In adaptive leadership, it's called work avoidance. It's like churches I know who have said stuff like, well, once we get into the new denomination, then we'll get our mission going. Well, I got news for you. I can tell you this from a whole lot of different denominations, that everyone who split, they're all dying, and everyone left behind are all dying. Mm-hmm. So whatever it is, the splitting is not the answer to that problem.
That
it might be an answer to another problem.
That is so true. I talked about that this morning in our staff mm-hmm. worship time and said that that's one of the big arguments people say is, mm-hmm. well, the reason the church is in decline is because they're becoming more secular, or they're more liberal, or they're more progressive, or they're more whatever, right? And so we have to leave and make a more fundamentalist kind of turn, and that way then we'll draw people to us. And I started looking through not only the secularization in America, the trends in Protestantism that's down 15% since 2007, and then, drum roll please, the Southern Baptist Church, Southern Baptists, which is that bastion of liberal wokeness, you know. And they've lost 500,000 members last year.
It's really not about that. We spend a lot of our time working on the wrong problem. And the reason we do is because it's a problem we understand and we have something we can do. And it's both sides. I mean, when our denomination was going through this split, I was on this kick of saying to folks, look, let them go as quick as possible. Just let everybody go. Let's let them go. Let them go. Let's give them money. Let them go. Let them go. Let's get back to work. Let them go. And what happened is everybody went, yes, 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 until they saw how much money they were taking out the door. And it was like, no.
That's our money.
Oh, good. We'll lawyer up. That's a good idea. always does. We always do so well when we start lawyering up. Like, we could have been done with this thing quickly. It was painful, but pull the mandate off. Let's get done. Oh, no.
Could I ask a couple of questions about the experiments? Because I find those to be really interesting. So what are some of the dynamics within some of the experiments that you're seeing or that are bearing fruit? Like, what are some of the things that people are doing to learn and to really see within their own culture?
Yeah. So the first thing you have to do is, once you identify, hey, here's this gap we have, and this gap we don't really understand. So as soon as you get people to stop trying to default to old practices, like, oh, we have a problem, I'm anxious, let's solve it this way. You get people to actually ask some questions. We talk about making observations. What do you see? What do you hear? What do you see? What do you hear? Let's get as many as possible. Let's get some interpretations. It could be this, it could be that. Let's get them as diverse as possible. What's the question you want to explore, right? What we found is, for example, in several of our churches, when they started exploring stuff like, why are we getting younger? Why aren't we getting younger? Why are we losing younger people? They assumed that what you have to do to get younger is you've got to alienate older people. So it just stopped the conversation. It just stopped it. Well, I was with a group yesterday who went, look, I think our mission is really about the next generation. So how do we talk to all of our grandparents about their mission. The church's mission is not about them. It's about their grandchildren. And literally a grandfather said, are you kidding me? That's the easiest conversation in the world. Why do we think that's so hard? Every grandparent wants more than anything their grandkids to be okay. Like, why are we stuck on this? And it was such an interesting thing because there's all this research that shows that the healthiest older people are people with a purpose.
Yes.
They need my friend Mark Roberts does this whole work on the Third Institute, that Third Initiative at Fuller Seminary, where literally the healthiest, thriving older people are people who discover in the third of life a purpose that is as strong as their vocation when they were younger. They are healthy, happy, more fulfilled than ever. So what we do instead is we pander to people rather than give them a purpose. And we pander thinking that it's going to make it okay, like we're nervous. What we're discovering in the experiments is that churches can focus on the younger generation in a way that everybody gets healthier, because it's the way humans are wired. We're wired to think that way. We just have to find a way to actually communicate it, right?
Yeah.
Another experiment we've learned a lot about how much our past practices of discipleship have not helped us.
Yeah.
So now people are really trying to figure out what kind of experiments can we do rethinking discipleship. And one that I'm doing a bunch of research on is we have outsourced discipleship. What happens if you put formation discipleship at the center of the work of the church and literally think about it as this is our primary work for the next generation, kind of the way Alan Kreider talks about the primary work of the first 400 years of the church was formation. It grew the most in a time when there's almost no evidence that anybody wrote a tract on either evangelism or church planting. They spent all their time talking about formation. Kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Are there any churches that you are seeing that are just kind of like starting over in a sense of whiteboarding these things? Because in some ways, like since the Enlightenment, we've cut up these things like human development is this, psychology is this, spiritual practices are this. But it seems that we live in these sense of we move through that like water rather than in categories. And it feels like that we're at a place within our own culture and society that we could actually really think about the way that we approach all of that very differently, right? So that discipleship is also something that's going to benefit your mental health, right? Small groups are not just about growing a church. They're all actually about the way you live more healthily in community, in a culture, in a city, right? How do we break some of this stuff down and start thinking about this in a more creative way?
Well, a big part of the problem, Matt, is that so many of our strategies were built around an assumption of growth. It's a little bit like if I was to say, hey, I only have two kids, you might have four, I guess your family is better than mine. Like, nobody would say that. So if you start rethinking, okay, what actually is the goal? What are we trying to produce? What is the problem we're trying to solve? What is the pain point we have? It actually starts focusing us more and more on our mission. So I'll give you one example of one of my clients. They're in an urban city in the South that has turned over demographically. They have about 2,000 members, and they're the most ethnically diverse staff I've ever seen. And the reason they said it is that their core value is they want to be missional. And what they mean by that is we're going to be a mission to our neighborhood. We care about our neighborhood. So as the demographics changed, they became more and more multi-ethnic. They're now about a 2,000 member multi-ethnic church. They only have one problem. They have 500 empty seats every week when he preaches, because they used to be 5,000. When the community was homogeneous, they were another big box mega church who built a big sanctuary because they thought they were going to be 10,000. That's where the trends were going. Mm. Well, as the community turned over, they decided we're going to keep our value, which is that we're going to reach our neighbors. We're not going to be a mega church that tries to attract people from all the suburbs. We're going to actually. So now they're only 2,000. Wow. The problem is they're 2,000 incredibly healthy, vibrant people who, if they weren't being haunted by a building that had 500 empty seats, they would think they were doing fine.
Right.
But as long as there are people who remember when they used to be 5,000, now he get the pastor says one of the hardest things in the world is to look at our church and say it is the most beautiful example I've seen of God answering my prayers for how our church reflects our neighborhood, and a bunch of our members feel as if we are failing because we just can't fill the seats that they thought they wanted to fill 20 years ago.
That's amazing. I talked about that Sunday, you know, the church growth movement and that homogeneous strategy, you know, the homogeneous principle. Yeah. I think it's you guys at Fuller like came up with all that stuff.
Homogeneity?
Was it Fuller?
It became known as the homogeneous growth phenomena, not principle. It was reflecting.
It was a phenomenon.
I call it the willow creaking of America.
But what it did was it played into, like, you know, going into a suburb where everyone looked the same, same socioeconomic, same values, same politics, same blah 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 blah. And then what happened is the culture grows and adapts and changes. Then what you find out is that the people that live in that same suburb are now very diverse. Even though they look the same and have the same socioeconomic, same house, same schools, there's more diversity there than ever before. And so now what happens to those churches? They split, and then they split again, and then they split again, and they split again, because we made the goal growth and not formation.
Yes.
Is what I hear you say.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. It's all the work you see about the big sort, you know, when people started sorting themselves. I mean, people now know they literally will go on Zillow and look for a neighborhood and they'll ask the question, you know, like, are there small little cafes and Starbucks, or are there big box stores and Chick-fil-A? They actually, the companies know which demographic they're going to flourish in more. So very quickly, people, without even saying, no, I want to go in a place where people share my values. Well, that's happening is we start sorting. Well, as soon as a community doesn't sort, like people come in, immigrants come in, and other people come in, churches start sorting. So instead of going with and being more deeply connected to our neighborhood as it is, we would rather grow. So we start participating in the sort that keeps people in kind of much more, what am I saying?
The sort. That's short for same.
Yeah.
The sort. That's what's happening. I mean, when you think about these denominations, I mean, we're sorting. And there are some people who are willing to live with, like I think of myself as conservative, but I'm willing to live within diversity and difference. But there's a lot of people that are not willing to do that. That's why you see a lot of the tribalism, you know, in American culture, too.
Yeah.
It's people sorting into smaller. So now, you know, it used to be Republican and Democrat. Well, now there's multiple different types of Republicans and multiple different types of Democrats. And if you don't align with one certain group, then you're Republican in name only. You're not really a Republican.
All right.
Or you're not really a Democrat. It's too hard to keep up with.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's killing us. The sorting is actually killing us, you know, and it's like it's what you've been talking about for a long time, which is it's the unity of the spirit. It's the bond of Christ. It's the body of Christ that is the goal. It's not being sorted into some like category that I live out in. It's saying, no, there's a oneness in Christ that we're called to.
When you get to a place to where a group of Americans say that the greatest threat to our country are other Americans, then, you know, we're in a bad place. That's where we are. Hey, man. Thanks for coming and being with us. He keeps freezing up. Oh, there you are. Sorry, you kind of froze up on
insights
us.
Insights that came out of the podcast. About that. I was saying something very, very profound.
Profound, yes.
Keep
we'll
going.
We'll say it. Now you're not frozen anymore.
Okay. One of the biggest insights that came out of the pandemic was people used to say, pastors and like me used to say, hey, look, when people get serious about the Bible, it'll change everything about their lives, even their politics. What we discovered is most people change their churches to fit their politics.
Yeah.
And that's one of the giant disappointments. Like one of the giant things that we have to talk about, like, is why our first loyalty is to a tribe of people who seem to share a different set of values than the ones that would shape us out of the scriptures that we hold as holy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder, though, too, if that's not like something, that's not a new phenomenon. That phenomenon that had been present for generations within the church had just got unmasked. Because truly, if we were following Jesus, we could punch a hole in poverty or in housing or in, you know, loving our neighbor as ourselves. But what we've done is we have created a sorting unit that got unmasked in the pandemic when we realized that actually our God is our own security. Our God is making sure that my stuff is okay. Right? That's our God. And when we have Jesus, it says, actually, you have to lose your life. You have to surrender your life. We go, that's not the Jesus I want to follow. Right? So I wonder if the pandemic at the end of the day just unmasked the generations of really security that we've been holding on to.
Yeah. I often said that the pandemic was apocalyptic. It revealed what was there.
Yeah.
Revealed a lot of what was there. Yeah. And now we're having to face it. I talked to a pastor, 8,000 member church, multi-site. He literally said to me, I wonder if I wasted my life, 31 years of being a pastor, and I watched the way my people talk to each other on Facebook, and they were vile to each other. Vile is the word to use.
Yeah.
To each other.
Yeah.
To each other.
Well, we're talking about
the family of God.
Right, to each other.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. Well, hey, man, thanks for being with us today and helping us with the conference, but then also just talking about some of this other stuff. It's sometimes I feel like we lament a lot because this is a lot worth lamenting. But,
yeah.
But there's a lot of good things, and it's good to hear about the good work you're doing with these churches going on, and we want to stay in contact. So, you know, we're selfish. We want to get all the good things you learn so we can steal those things from you.
Absolutely.
And then we don't have to do quite as much work, but then we still get all the goodie out of it. That's kind of it's called innovation.
That's what I'm here for.
Well, hey, bud, good to see you. Enjoy a good bottle of wine.
Do my best.
Sometime soon. We appreciate you, brother. Take care.
You too. Say, guys. Bye.
See ya.
Make sure if you like the podcast, or even if you don't, subscribe.
Smash the
like button. And send along to a friend. So all those things help. If you leave a 5-star rating or a good rating, or if you subscribe, or if you like, all those things, like, they're helpful in the algorithm, right? In the cloud. Right,
John,
Jeff?
John will come mow your lawn for it, too.
Yes, we'll do that. We'll send someone to mow your lawn. Well, I'm John Stevens.
I'm Matt Russell.
And this is Pod Have Mercy.